Hey everybody, Marcus here. In this video, I wanted to put together an existential account of what it must be like for a reasonably attractive woman to hit the wall. And the wall, of course, is that phenomenon MGTOW have branded as the aesthetic cliff that women fall off of in their early 30s. Now, I find the contemporary explanation of the wall lacking in many respects. We say that a woman has hit the wall when you can start to see wrinkles, you know, gray hairs, and a general decline in the appearance of youth and vitality. We also refer to this period as the point in which men begin to show less and less interest in the woman, that she can no longer get the attention she could before. Though these phenomena all may, you know, all be true, they do not bring us any closer to understanding what it must be like to hit the wall. As men, our life plays itself backwards to that of a woman's, where she will start at her best, ride the plateau of youth and beauty for a decade and a half, you know, then rapidly crash. A man will start in his weakest position as far as the opposite sex is concerned, at least. He will have little to no resources or skills to offer. His life begins in hardship, and then only in his older years, in his 30s, does he find himself in a position of strength, a position he has never held before. As such, we cannot simply analogize an experience in the male life to that of the wall. Now, let us imagine an attractive 20-year-old woman, say 5'5", 110 pounds, solid B cup, long hair, a fair complexion, and a neotenous countenance. And perhaps it is this description that best serves as our springboard. For what qualities of these can such a woman lose by hitting the wall? I mean, surely she will neither shrink nor grow. She can maintain her weight at 110 pounds, her breasts will neither shrink nor grow, and her hair will remain long if she so chooses to keep it that way. With this in place, we are left with a fair complexion, which, absent extreme sun damage, will remain fair long into old age. However, the last quality we enumerated, neoteny, this quality must surely be that which the wall robs women of. Now, Girl Writes What put out a very interesting video on the subject of neoteny a few years ago. Her account of neoteny is oriented around the evolutionary aspect of this phenomenon, and as such, most of her content is out of scope of what we're trying to do in this video. Neoteny, as it pertains to this video, is the retaining of childlike features into adult age. So, this means that women retain childlike features into adult life. You know, features such as an absence of body and facial hair, a higher pitched voice, you know, smaller stature, larger eyes, more delicate jaw, a larger forehead, you know, smaller mouth, shorter nose, more rounded chin, softer body, and smoother skin. Neoteny also affects behavior, you know, behaviors such as crying, curiosity, playfulness, and emotional expressiveness. And do we not mean these things when we say that men are attracted to youth and beauty? Well, surely we do, for we do not say the opposite. We do not say that body and facial hair on a woman is attractive, nor is a deep voice, you know, higher than 6 foot tall. Nor do we compliment women on beady eyes, a chiseled jaw, a large mouth, a long nose, or sandpaper rough skin. No, we desire those childlike features and indeed call them youth and beauty. And if these things are absent in a woman, we do not call her beautiful. We do not look to win her interest, nor do we pay attention to her at all. And indeed, how does our disposition toward a neotenous woman differ from our disposition to children? We look upon children as innocent, cute, harmless, in need of protection. We want to be nice to them at best and not see harm to them come to them at worst. We defer to them as we do not hold the same standard of expectations for children as we do for adults. This deference, is it not simply an exemption from responsibility? For if a 10-year-old ran up to you and started punching you with impunity, would you swing back as if the attack came from an adult? Well, surely not. You would show deference. And from this deference, the child would soon be, you know, build the expectation that an assault will be met with no more than harsh words. An expectation completely detached from the natural consequences that would come had they been only a bit older or had they done this to an animal. But let us go back to our attractive 20-year-old woman for the time being. From childhood all the way leading up to hitting the wall, she has been neotenous. As such, it follows that she has never known life otherwise. If this is the case, then it follows that she has been deferred to her whole life. As this deference is always the case, then she surely does not experience it as deference. For how can someone tell the difference between special treatment and just treatment if they have only been subject to special treatment? Though she may be familiar with stories of others being treated worse, I mean, those stories are as detached from her day-to-day existential experience as is famine from a citizen in the first world. Though she understands this worse treatment, she only understands it as a theoretical thing, you know, never applied to her person, and as such, no more than a curiosity that enters her mind in passing, if at all. Now, this deference, in her mind, is normal behavior. Anything less is considered rude, cruel, assholish, mean, or unfair. A man may be exerting special effort on this woman with the intention of winning her favor. However, as this sort of deference is normal to her, he is in no way distinguishing himself. In fact, he is only behaving normally, appropriately to how she expects men to behave towards her. As such, she has no reason to feel the need to reciprocate, as he has done, well, nothing to deserve any extra effort on her part. Though this man may be secretly breeding resentment for the absence of reciprocity of any sort, he is naively unaware that she is unaware of his deference. From her perspective, he is not doing extra nice things to win her favor. No, he is merely not an asshole. To her, the deference of the nice guy is the minimum bar to not be considered mean, rude, cruel, or an unjust person. Now, to distinguish himself, he would need to invest resources vastly in excess of this general aura of deference she is accustomed to, or to not defer at all. If he does not defer, however, he will still be an asshole. But if he has the alpha male aura, as you know, explored in my video on alpha males, he'll still get laid. If he is not an alpha in the sense of that account, then he will either just be an asshole or creepy. Either way, he will still end up as an asshole when described to her girlfriends. Now, how does this woman meet men? Well, we can assert a number of premises uncontroversially. Firstly, rejection is painful. Secondly, approaching another person reveals intent and places one in danger of rejection. This intent will then need to be met with a response. As the person who has revealed intent has already shown their hand, the person responding is in no danger of rejection, therefore at no risk of pain. Men approach women, therefore men are in danger of pain. As a corollary, women are in no danger of the pain of rejection. I also request that one concession is made in my account, a concession I feel is not controversial, as it is true of most people. This is that I assert women are hedonistic by nature. Most people are hedonistic by nature, but I believe women are exemplars. So if women are hedonists, they will avoid pain and attempt to maximize pleasure. As approaching men has the potential for rejection and therefore pain, and men are already approaching them, then it follows that a woman would avoid pain by not approaching. As being approached is a statement of approval, then it follows that being approached is more desirable than not being approached at all. As such, she will prefer to be approached over not being approached to gain the pleasure of approval. To not be approached is to neither gain approval nor suffer rejection. As such, it is a neutral outcome. In this way, a woman will not approach to avoid the pain of rejection. She prefers being approached to not being approached and stands neutral on not being approached at all. Now, our 20-year-old, however, would consider an undesirable man approaching her as a compliment if he did not come across as creepy. She would still desire that an undesirable man approach, be polite, graciously be rejected, and then graciously leave as soon as possible. However, she would prefer that a creepy man not approach at all, as she would find it painful and not pleasurable. Okay, we don't need to concern ourselves with what creepy is, as it's irrelevant to the argument. However, if women were approached by creepy men to a large degree, then the net sum of all approaches they experienced would lead to pain. As such, women would need to wager the pain suffered from rejection versus the net pain suffered from being approached by creepy guys. As women still prefer to be approached, it is necessarily the case then that there's substantially more net pain associated with the active courting strategy of risking rejection than the passive courtship strategy, which may involve being approached in a painful manner. If this were not the case, women would actively approach men as the less painful of the two options. So, in this way too, men defer to women where the active-passive courtship strategy is concerned. And now, we must look a little closer at the deference we show to women. Earlier we said that the deference shown to women by men originated from her neoteny, and as such would be the kind of deference appropriate to this quality. As we have already asserted that neoteny is the retention of those childlike qualities, then it follows that this deference would be akin to the kind we show to children. Though we do not treat women as children, we defer to them in ways equivalent to children. So, how do we defer to children? Okay, if a child, having never encountered stairs, took them for granted, surely he would fall down those stairs. The consequences to this, could range from a mere bruise to death. As parents, we do not wish the child to suffer these consequences. Therefore, we remove the possibility of these consequences by blocking the staircase with some childproof obstruction. As such, we defer to children by minimizing or completely removing consequences. Why do we minimize the consequences for children? Well, it can be said that we do this because we assume the child simply does not or cannot know any better. However, this is not completely true. Now, let me clarify what I mean. Though it can be assumed that a one-year-old indeed cannot know that they can bang their head if they fall off the stairs, we do not actually have a problem with the child banging its head. For if indeed we did, we would also need to safeguard the cushy sofa in the living room to prevent the one-year-old from banging their head against that too. No, we do not have a problem of them banging their head. We are attempting to prevent them from banging their head against something hard, as banging your head against something hard will lead to pain, of which we consider death of the highest kind. Therefore, it follows that the consequence we guard children against is pain. So we defer to children in ways that minimize or eliminate the child suffering pain. But is this the extent to which we defer to children? Do we also defer to children by granting them pleasures? For there are many parents who spoil their children with extravagances if they can afford them, while many who cannot afford such extravagances would do so if they could. Do parents not say that they want their kids to have a better life than they did? Yeah, they do. But is it the case that minimizing pain is a type of deference different from the type that grants pleasure? Well, perhaps let me ask this question another way. If a two-year-old has never been given chocolate, they would never ask for it, nor have a desire for it, as one cannot have a desire for that which one is not aware of. In such a case, would giving the child chocolate not be about minimizing pain, but be about giving pleasure? Well, it surely seems that way. So, what we have done by giving the child chocolate for the first time is create a new desire in them. But why would we do this? Why would we create a desire within a child? Well, we would do this to create an opportunity for them to gain pleasure by satisfying that desire. We do this because we, ourselves, find pleasure in fulfilling this desire and would like to extend that opportunity to the child. But we go a step further with children. We do not merely recommend chocolate to a child. We also go out, buy it, and give it to the child. This differs from the sort of recommendations, friends make to each other in that an adult may recommend a restaurant, but they will not take that friend to the restaurant and pay for their meal. So in this way, we defer to children as far as pleasure is concerned. We defer to children by introducing pleasures to them, by facilitating the child in experiencing this pleasure. As a consequence to this, by the way, we create desires in children. So, let us summarize. The deference that is derived from neoteny is twofold. The first kind of deference is the active minimalization of or elimination of pain. The second kind of deference is the introduction and facilitation of pleasures. Now, at this point, you might be thinking to yourself, Marcus, but surely we also give pain to children in the form of punishment for the purpose of discipline. Well, you would be right to raise this observation. But why do we introduce pain in this way? Well, perhaps the argument can go as follows. Imagine a child tries to stick a fork into an electrical socket. If we catch a child doing this, we may very well yell at them. I mean, this yelling would be painful for the child. The child now associates attempts at sticking a fork into an electrical socket with pain. Now, this is the correct and natural association. However, the pain from yelling is a mere fraction of what the pain would be from being electrocuted. As such, we have introduced a small pain to remove the possibility of a much greater pain. The net difference in the pain of being yelled at and that of being electrocuted is much greater than the pain of being yelled at. Therefore, the child experiences less pain overall. So punishment for the purpose of discipline, too, becomes a form of deference that attempts to minimize or eliminate pain. Now, as we have already said that the deference shown to children is of the same kind as that which men show to women, then it follows that men will defer to women in these two ways. So, let us consider some common examples of how this, how these two forms of deference are played out in the male-female dynamic. First, let us look at how men attempt to minimize or eliminate pain for women. Men carry heavy things for women. We open jars, we squash spiders, we do the driving. Approaching women is also of this kind of deference, as we have shown earlier. One example from, well, my personal life is that I would swap my meal with a woman at a restaurant if she ordered something she didn't like. We invented washing machines, air conditioners, ready-made meals, birth control, tampons, bras, and pretty much anything we think will remove the slightest amount of pain from a woman's life. But all these mundane and trivial examples do not compare to the ultimate manifestations of this form of deference. We are the ones checking on what made that noise in the middle of the night. We give women seats on lifeboats at our expense. We go to war so they don't have to. We defer to women by being disposable. What about examples of the second kind of deference, the deference of introducing and facilitation of pleasures? Well, we scout out the best restaurants and take women there. We take them on exotic trips. We plan scavenger hunts for their birthdays. We write them poetry. We open doors, pull out chairs, and perform all the other forms of chivalry. Hell, we invent all sorts of systems of conduct that will give them a feeling of being special. And the most damning of all is that we introduce women to the lovely idea that it is men who are to pay for everything by actually paying for everything. The notion of being pampered, spoiled, the princess. I mean, men will introduce the pleasure of being fought over to the extent that the Trojan War has set the precedent that the love of a woman is worth the death of thousands of men in its pursuit. Do men know any of these pleasures for themselves? No. But we introduce them to women nonetheless, for we can imagine how awesome they can be. These two deferences can be expressed with these simple sentiments. I would never allow any harm to come to my children or wife. Nothing is too good for my children and wife. And of course, women and children first. But then, what is it exactly that hitting the wall means? Well, as we have stated earlier in the video, it is what a woman experiences when she loses her neoteny. But what would cause this loss of neoteny? I mean, surely there's some connection to age, but that is not sufficient to account for it. After all, men lose their neoteny at a much younger age. What causes this loss of neotenous features in women in their late 20s and early 30s is the same thing that causes men to lose their neotenous features when they start to hit puberty. A surge of testosterone in their bloodstream. The body chemistry of a woman alters in a subtle way that allows for the effects of testosterone to have a more pronounced effect on the woman. This is documented in the book by Dr. Crenshaw entitled The Alchemy of Love and Lust. Now, there is another phenomenon that has been floating around at the level of common knowledge these days. It is the notion that women hit their sexual peak in their mid-30s. Now, I'm inclined to accept this observation to the extent that sexual peak is understood as desire to have sex. I dismiss the notion that a woman's sexual peak is in her mid-30s as far as ideal age to give birth. I mean, we clearly know that the chance of birth defects and miscarriages increases significantly as a woman approaches her 40s. Now, this sexual peak very nicely coincides with the concept of the wall. Well, if indeed testosterone begins to be a more significant player in a woman's chemistry, then the loss of neoteny and an increase in sexual drive indeed makes sense for a woman in her early to mid-30s. But if this is the case, then what is the existential consequence of hitting the wall? Firstly, when a woman loses her neoteny, she will necessarily lose those subtle traits that give her her feminine aura. She becomes more masculine. I mean, she acquires traits that make her look more like a man. If this is the case, then it's no surprise that a man will find her less attractive. As a further consequence, the deference she had experienced to this point will begin to decrease as she's no longer of a kind who commands deference. The world becomes crueler. The behavior she had come to expect from men becomes less common. I mean, men seem to turn meaner. It appears to her there are more assholes than there used to be, that men have somehow gotten worse. Where have all the good men gone? I mean, she begins, for the first time, to experience just behavior towards her, as opposed to deference. However, as she has lived a life of being deferred to and had considered that normal, just behavior appears unjust. And with the sense of injustice come the feelings of anger. Like Aristotle would say, she will feel anger, but not quite be certain what to direct this anger at. So in this way, it must follow that when a woman hits the wall, she in turn experiences her own form of the red pill rage. Let's refer to it as the post-wall rage. Now, the two types of deference we had enumerated previously need to be evaluated post-wall. The first type was the minimization or elimination of pain. So, leading up to the wall, men would attempt to make life as painless as possible for women. After the wall, it would follow that men slowly stopped to defer in this way. As such, women would now begin to suffer natural consequences more frequently. Now, these natural consequences would be of two types. The first type would be consequences that she had never suffered before, or only very rarely, you know, such as being refused assistance or being passed over. The second type of consequence would be of the type that she only knew by proxy. And the proxy style of consequences would be akin to the child who was yelled at instead of being electrocuted. And a real-world example of this proxy consequence would be something like the following. Imagine that a woman who owns a car always had a man bring her car in for oil changes. Though the woman paid for the oil change, she was never inconvenienced in having to bring in the car to the shop herself. And though this might seem like a contrived example, it's really a placeholder for any pain that was partially mitigated for her by a man. So coworkers helping her with her work, or being helped while moving, babysitting her pets, getting lifts, not having to do the driving, I mean, being allowed to cut in line, you know, and so on. These are all subtle examples of how a portion of the consequences are offloaded to a proxy. So, where she would previously enjoy her full paycheck while offloading a portion of her work on a male coworker, she is now required to exert the full amount of effort for the same pay. In the same way, where she would previously enjoy the benefit of owning a pet and still have the convenience to drop it off when it inconvenienced her, now she is stuck with either paying someone for the same benefit or foregoing the freedom that not having a pet has. So in this way, without having men defer to her, she is finally facing the full range of pain that comes from the consequences of her life choices. To her, this becomes a manifestation of, you know, pain, frustration, and general inconvenience. It then follows that the quality of her life decreases while seemingly no aspect of her immediate situation has changed. To resolve this difference in quality of life, she concludes that the people around her, namely men, have changed. And in this way, do the men, who no longer defer, slowly start turning into assholes as the post-wall years go on, each year yielding less and less deference. The second type of deference, the sort in which men would introduce and facilitate pleasures, also begins to go away. However, something very interesting happens here. You see, we said earlier that when a new pleasure is introduced, it also has the consequences of producing a new desire. As such, our post-wall woman had over a decade of men introducing desires into her. And these desires, however, up to this point, were also being fulfilled by men. Post-wall, however, the desires in her remain, but the fulfillment of them begins to disappear. So she is left with memories of various pleasures men used to facilitate, but no longer do. And in this way, too, men appear worse than they used to be, for she does not see that men still facilitate pleasures for women. She does not see this because she is no longer of the kind to which those men would defer to. Where men used to put in the effort in orchestrating a date, now, well, they merely show up and wing it. And of course, she might have to pay for herself on a date as well. I mean, men stop buying her drinks at bars. They don't bring flowers. They don't surprise her with weekend getaways or cute messages during the day. Well, in a nutshell, men no longer work for her attention or approval. The supposed romance disappears. So it would seem that when a woman is no longer deferred to, she will suffer a thousand little frustrations and inconveniences as a result. The post-wall rage that I had mentioned before now seems to become a brewing rage and not one of immediate intensity. You know, a rage from a thousand paper cuts that takes years to fully develop. And under this account, what would it then mean when she says that some man makes her feel young again? Well, surely it must mean that after many years post-wall, a man has deferred to her in the way she remembers from her youth. Further, a post-wall woman's animosity towards young women becomes intelligible. For this post-wall woman witnesses men deferring to this younger woman in a way that reminds her of a time that, well, will never return. Bearing witness to this sort of behavior is doubly painful. In the first way, is that which we have already mentioned, you know, by stirring memories, but also in a second way. In the second way, it shatters her illusion that it is men who have changed, that men no longer do this for women. Seeing a younger woman experience this for the post-wall woman is a clear testament that it is not men who have changed, but it is her who has changed. Ah, but perhaps doubly painful was misspoken. For there is a third way in which she suffers. If indeed it is the case that a woman loses her neocony due to an increase in the role that testosterone plays in her system, then it also follows that she will acquire some male behavioral traits. She will become more competitive, and as already said, gain an increased sex drive. So in this third way, our post-wall woman will desire sex significantly more. She will also be fueled by a need to compete with younger women, but fail to win except through gratuitous promiscuity. And in this way, we can see the aggressive cougar type come into being. But let us consider for a moment if experiencing the wall is the same for all women. It is given that all women hit the wall, as this is merely a biological factor, but what is not as certain is if the existential experience of the wall is consistent between women. First, we have asserted that the loss of neoteny is that which the wall robs a woman of. We have also argued that it is the deference women experience pre-wall that differentiates their existential experience before and after the wall. With the loss of neoteny, a post-wall woman also loses the deference that comes with it. Now, the question we must answer is whether or not the loss of this deference is equally meaningful for all women, or if there are cases in which the loss of this deference is less significant. Now, we can imagine that the wall would be meaningless for a woman for whom the loss of deference would be meaningless. This would entail that a woman experienced just treatment throughout her life as opposed to deferred treatment. For such a woman, the wall would constitute no meaningful change, as she was not deferred to before hitting the wall and would not be deferred to after the wall. So for this woman, there would be no increase in pain nor withdrawal of facilitated pleasures. So it follows that the impact that hitting the wall has on a woman is proportionately related to the degree to which she was deferred to before hitting the wall. So hitting the wall would be most significant to the most neotenous woman, or more generally, the most beautiful woman. However, I think that this conclusion is incomplete, for it does not necessarily follow that necessarily deference follows beauty. But opportunity for deference does necessarily follow beauty. Therefore, the most beautiful woman will be those who have the most opportunity for deference. However, it is not the case that they will partake of this deference. So it would seem that, well, hitting the wall would be most significant for women who partake most of deference. And beautiful women have the most opportunity to participate in deference. So in this way, a very beautiful woman who does not partake of deference from men would still not find hitting the wall as immensely significant, while a below average woman who partook fully of the deference shown her would experience the wall more intensely. However, we have also asserted that women are hedonists. As such, it follows that they will always maximize pleasure and minimize pain. In addition, we have also established the premise that a woman would have been deferred to by men from the outset, and as such not known the difference between just and deferred behavior. As such, she would partake of all deference offered following from the first premise. She would do this because she would feel it was normal behavior. This follows from the second premise. Now, with all this said, it follows that a woman for whom the wall would be insignificant is not really possible. Therefore, we must conclude that all women experience some degree of impact from the wall. Now, how would a woman maximize her pleasure? Well, it would appear that to do this, she would need to maximize the amount of deference she would partake in. For any given man, this man has expendable resources that would allow for a certain amount of benefit he could provide for a woman. Simply stated, this means that a man only has so much time and money that he is willing and capable of investing in deference to a woman. He may only be willing to, say, buy her a pair of shoes, but won't in addition to this buy her a dress. In order for the woman to get both the dress and the shoes, she would need to capitalize on the deference of two separate men, as each man will only defer to some natural limit specific to his means. This also extends to time. A man may only be willing, say, to babysit her pet one day a week, so she would need two such men in order to go away for the weekend. So it follows that a woman would maximize deference by maximizing the number of men from who she draws such deference. Now, where individual men only have a set limit in time and resources, so too, she only has a limited amount of time to participate in this deference. So, to further maximize on her pleasure, she would need to find a way to maximize the quality of the deference she partakes of. After all, a week in Hawaii is surely of a higher kind than having someone watch your pet for you. Now, what increases the quality of deference a man would exert upon a woman? Sex. So, she would need to have sex with these men. Now, if we combine both maximizing the number of men and maximizing the quality of deference from each man, what do we get? The cock carousel. Now, you might be saying to yourself at this point, but Marcus, if she is trading sex for other benefits, how is this deference as opposed to a simple economic exchange? Well, the answer to this is simple. The benefit a woman receives in exchange for sex is not commensurate compensation. She gets orders of magnitude more in return for sex than the sex itself is worth. The deference is the man being willing to take that bad deal in the first place, because under no other situation would he take such a bad deal. So, in returning to our argument, it appears that a woman who rides the cock carousel is in fact maximizing the deference she can partake in by maximizing both the number of men who defer and the quality of the deference they offer. This, in turn, maximizes her pleasure, which coheres with our hedonistic thesis. This also has the side effect of maximizing the number of desires she will acquire throughout her pre-wall years, and it will also maximize the impact the wall will have on her. It is stated that, well, riding the cock carousel ruins women, and in a banal way, it is true, in that men do not want a woman who has had multiple partners. However, the argument we have presented so far paints a much more nefarious account. A woman who rides the carousel will be ruined within her very soul. She would have acquired such a large number of desires that they can never be fulfilled by one man. I mean, it's simply not possible. After all, it took the entire carousel to fulfill them. So in this way, no one man will ever meet these desires, no matter the man. And the truth in this can be inferred from the argument we had made about the natural limits of time and money on the part of one man. I mean, even if a man has billions of dollars, he still only has 24 hours in a day. As such, he will never have the time to allocate to her that a harem of men would. So, it appears that a carousel rider is the type of woman for whom hitting the wall would be the most painful. And on this point, I would like to close this discussion of the wall. Though much more can undoubtedly be said, I'll leave that for another video. For me, I think the notion of the post-wall rage is a new idea that might be worth exploring by the MGTOW community. I mean, how does female behavior change after the wall? Do they go through the stages of grieving? I mean, at what point does the male and female sex drive overlap? Does the effect of the wall end at menopause, or does it get worse? I mean, all interesting and unexplored questions. But for now, thanks for listening. Go team.